to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Risk Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today I'm joined by two very special guests on two different continents. So making a return from his last episode with us, which was in December 2020, Mr. Scott Goldman at Goldmanstagram 1. Hello, Scott. Lovely to see you.
Hey, Roman. Good to see you. Was it that long ago? Oof.
Oh, I know. Well, you look the same. I look much older. So it's been a while. And look, it's great to see you. It's good to see you, man. And well, you're the special guest, so I guess our very, very special guest, our most eminent guest, shall we say, is someone that you and I have great respect, and we actually mentioned on our last episode we were chatting with, making his Fifth Risk debut, and I'm very, very excited about this. Hopefully you can hear it in my voice, Mr. Martin Brown, watchmaker extraordinaire. Hello, Martin. Welcome.
Yay. Hello, Roman. Glad to be here, and nice to see you guys.
Oh, it's wonderful
hello
to have
from
you.
Spain.
Yes, well, you're jumping. You're revealing your secret location. I thought you were like the president. You know, we're never allowed to reveal where you are because you're sort of, you know, person to be protected.
Spain's a big place. He won't tell you where he is in Spain. He's in Spain.
Right. So a roving ambassador of watchmaking. He's in Spain today. He'll be in somewhere else tomorrow. So, you know, you gotta be in the know. But Martin, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I've been a huge fan of your work. Your name has been mentioned on the Fifth Risk Independent Thinking for a long time. And for me personally, you've been one of the sort of formative influences on my own watch collecting. So it is an absolute joy to have you with us.
Thank you, Roman.
All right. Now, I won't fangirl all over you the whole episode, I promise. I get this out in the first 5 minutes and then I get serious again. So, all right. Well, we have a very, very loose, very fluid structure here. But what we tend to do is we start every episode, we'll do a drink check, a wrist check, and a location check. So, actually, Scott, we might start with you. I mentioned we're in different continents. So, tell us where you are. Tell us what's in the mug, cup, vase, whatever you're imbibing from, and what's on the wrist.
So I'm in Malibu, California. Oh, Pacific time zone. It is my trusted Martin Braun EOS tells me it's 1:20 in the afternoon local time, which is yesterday for you, Roman.
It's all just crazy. It's all metaphysical anomalies everywhere.
Well,
it's
but
crazy.
You're my tomorrow right now.
Yeah.
So,
It's much better.
What's really cool is I'm wearing what I think is the coolest watch in the world. It's the reissue of the Martin Braun EOS, which tells me the sunrise and sunset
in Malibu.
I gotta say, it's very goddamn accurate, Martin. I'm pretty damn impressed with this movement because, as I told you a couple weeks ago, it's right on the nuts. I mean, right on the nuts. Anyways, that's me. That's where I am. Thanks.
And drink wise, we're hanging on the edge of our seat. Drink wise.
Oh, yeah. Well, hang no more, Roman. It is a Topo Chico, which is mineral water, served in a Stella Artois glass because it's only 1:20 in the afternoon here. I'm going to let my good friend tell you about whatever beer he's drinking right now because it's not quite 5 o'clock yet.
No, look, you
in
get,
LA. In LA, it's not 5.
No, look, you get full marks for trying. And once again, to our listeners, you know, we don't condone reckless drinking, but we encourage moderate consumption of whatever beverage floats your boat.
I'm not judging anybody on day drinking. I'm just not going to do it today.
Correct. Well done. But lovely to see you. Beautifully done.
Thank you.
Our eminent maestro, Martin, we'll throw over to you. So what's on the wrist? What's in the drink if you're drinking something? And where you are? You've sort of given us a hint already.
Right now, you see, I'm wearing nothing because the reason is we live on a campground and I don't want to walk around with a couple of luxury watches. That's the main
sensible
reason.
Sensible.
And my drink of the day is one of my favorite mineral water is Lancharon. from the Sierra Nevada in Spain. And as you said, we are in south of Spain, in the region of Andalusia, to stay over the winter here in the south and enjoy the warm weather.
Oh, that's lovely. Where is home for you? What's home base for Martin Brown? Where do you live typically?
In central Switzerland.
Central Switzerland. Okay, yes. Now I can see why you would...
Yeah, close to Lucerne.
Right. Oh, beautiful. Oh, very, very nice. I can see why you don't want to be in Switzerland in November. We're recording this in Sean. That's understandable. Understandable. Yeah. Lovely.
Yeah. Ironically, it's a nice day there today, but that's a separate issue.
How can there be a nice day when Martin's not there? Come on, Scott.
I thought you weren't going to fangirl. All right, I see.
Once we do the location check, it's done, I promise. Okay.
24-hour heavy rainfall and maximum temperature of 5 degrees.
That sounds horrendous.
Today, blue skies and 21, 22 degrees. So it's really a big difference.
Delightful. Yeah. Delightful. All right, lovely. All right, well, so I guess I'll do mine. Thank you, guys. I'm in Melbourne, Australia. So we have a USA, Europe, Australia tri-continental link. So hopefully the internet lines up. So that's quite magical. So finding a common time to record is a nightmare. So I knew one of us was going to have to do something unsociable. So, you know, it's 7:24 a.m. now where I am. So,
hey, Roman, because time zoning is really important in our watch world of horology, let's just kind of figure that out for a sec, can we?
Yeah, of course.
It's 1:25 where I am.
P.M., yep.
Okay. Right. And it's 8:25 where you are, 9:25 where you are, Martin.
Right.
Saturday.
Yeah.
Where you are.
Yeah.
It's Sunday.
Indeed. Yeah. I know. If only there was a watch to sort of do all of this for us, you know.
Ah, if only.
And maybe show like a time zone, like a sunrise and a sunset kind of thing. So you could plan for these kind of recordings. And you, anyway, yes, somebody should really make one of those.
Well, I think somebody might have figured that out.
Oh, well, we definitely need to hear more, I think, about this. No, but you're right. I mean, this is the joy of modern technology, is actually having been able to do this kind of stuff. It is wonderful. It is really wonderful. So Melbourne, Australia, 7-something. So my drink of choice is actually even less exciting than the mineral waters that you guys are drinking. I'm having a cup of tea, which is a bit sad.
As you should at, 7:26 in the morning, Sunday morning?
Yeah, look, you know, I mean, occasionally a gin and tonic has been consumed on this podcast at about 7:25. But I am solo parenting today, and you know, it's one of those things that
just one G&T, right? Just correct. One.
Well, but a big one, you know. But a big one, you know. It's the number still. It's still one standard drink. You just sort of, the standard becomes ever larger.
Understood.
Yeah, like a US oil barrel is the standard size, you know. No, we do a good gin and tonic on this show. In terms of on the wrist, we're going to be talking about a very special watch, which you've already mentioned, Scott. So it's on your wrist, an EOS, a new edition EOS. I am very, very lucky that I have an original EOS, and I'm extremely lucky I have an EOS with the serial number 01.
You're a very rare dog you have there.
I am. Well, it's actually even more special than that, because each of these watches are set for a particular location. The watch I have is set for Rome, and it has an engraving ROM on the back. Now, Roman is my name, and there's ROM, there's ROM on the back of the watch. So this is one of those, when I saw this, I'm like, this is, you know, customization by accident. It's like universe smiles on you now and then when you're collecting kind of thing. So this watch holds a very special place in my heart. So I'm delighted to have this. I also have a couple of other Martin's watches as well. I said I've been a big collector. I don't tend to collect vertically. You know, I don't collect watches like that usually. But when I looked at the watch box, Martin, I have more of your watches than I have anybody else's watches, you know. So I have a Notos watch, and maybe we'll talk about that as well. And probably my second favorite after the EOS is the Celine, which is your amazing moon phase watch with a meteorite dial. So
Let me get mine.
Yeah, there you go. So it's like we haven't practiced this, we promise. You know, we usually, if we were going to practice, we would get, you know, we would get this aligned better, but we're clearly big fans of your work, Martin. I was actually looking back when I mentioned that you were once sort of influential in my own personal collecting journey and stuff. Before I started collecting watches, I was really interested in independent watchmaking. I started collecting watch catalogs because that was the only thing I could afford as a young student and all of that. And I actually bought a Martin Braun catalog that came in a box like this. And it was extra special. You can't see it on the video, but it's actually signed by Mr. Martin Braun. There's a little signature on the pen.
Wow.
And I still have it. Exactly. So when I say it was one of the early, you were one of the early influences, you know, it still has like the price list from 2007.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah. And so when I remember reading those Watch Time magazines and IW magazines, I think they were called, the first thing I remember I met you, there was a full page ad of you looking very youthful, much like you look now, but sitting in this desk, and it was like a Martin Braun independent watchmaker ad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very rare to see an independent watchmaker advertising. Must have been 2005, 6 or 7 or something. So you were really one of the early wave young go-getters. So it's cool to see you kind of come full journey, which is very exciting.
You know, Roman, it's interesting. When I remember when I started reading Watch Time, I'd always see this. It was an ad for Martin Braun. It was sort of further towards the back of the book.
It was, yeah.
Right? And there were always a couple of guys standing around him. And there was sexy young Martin Braun holding an award or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm like, who is this guy? He's like a German guy. Of course, like, because that's how stupid I was at the time, right? Because I didn't understand that really Saxony watchmaking was truly something special. Swiss watchmaking, I'm not going to make noise about it because it's, you know, it's all sort of intermingled. But the way that the Germans were approaching watchmaking and still do, like Long and Sona, and you and I have talked about it, Zenith, it's different. And it's different on another level, and I believe it's a level up. It's very special, you know. When I look at my EOS, or I look at my, you know, my Celine, you know, I think about things that Martin does that are very DNA driven. You know, this is more of, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, Martin, so you can just kick my shins from over there in Spain. But you know, this is like his father's DNA. This coin edge casing is part of his father's heritage. And I love the fact that, you know, you can look at a Martin Braun watch, which doesn't even have to have a Martin Braun marking on it, and you know who did it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, I want to make one more comment. You keep talking about independent watchmakers. As you know, this man is one of my best friends in the world. Believe me, I'm going to call it codependent watchmaking, but we'll make that a whole other show.
Oh dear. You're very right about, look, you're absolutely right about the kind of the DNA and design. We'll talk about complications, of course, and the astronomical style. But yes, design is very clear. There is a absolute thread of Martin Braun kind of watch design all the way from the earliest days all the way up to now.
Agreed.
So, which is lovely, which is very rare to get. So maybe, look, maybe a good place to start for our listeners who are less familiar with your work, Martin, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, how you got into watchmaking, what's the career path? Like, how did you end up being in watches at all?
Okay, so my father, myself, we run the watch case factory, and we made watch cases for a lot of Swiss brands and German brands. And we had a very good business, but it was 1919 when the first Iraq war started.
Right.
And we had an export rate around about 80-90% to the Middle East. And all of a sudden, the market broke down. So we were in big trouble. And at that time, I made my master degree. And I came back more to the mechanical stuff. And then I had the idea, right, okay, we make more mechanical watches. But at that time, it was almost impossible to get an ETAA 7750 or 2892. The market was empty. The quality was bad. And this was not nicely decorated. So I was kind of frustrated. And I found then the possibility to buy old vintage pocket watch movements. And we bought them in auctions and markets. And we made the repair, refreshed them. And then we made one-of-a-kind piece. Made for each movement a separate case. And we became also very successful with that. And I was then educated by different movement constructions, because if you go to a master degree, you know, they give you only the standard stuff. But nobody gives you, for instance, a minute repeater and says, hey, student, here is a minute repeater worth 20,000 bucks, please.
I flip it together. Sure.
And then the final step was then that my father approached his retirement age. And so we had a very good combination. You know, I was the mechanical guy. I was working on the lacy and the watchmaker stuff. And my father made the goldsmith stuff. And nowadays, everything is on a CNC machine. But it makes no sense on a CNC machine to produce one-of-a-kind case.
Of course.
And so I said, okay, it's for me not possible to go this way ahead without my father. And then I tried to find a way on my own. And I was always fascinated by astronomy. And so the idea came up that that I can make a wristwatch with sunrise and sunset an indication. And in my masterpiece, I had a equation of time, which I developed by myself. And so I had it was a natural growing process. And I was then really, really fascinated to do something astronomical, because everybody has a chronograph or a split second or whatever, which is good, by the way. But I want to make something more with fantasy. And so I said, sunrise and sunset is a perfect thing. So it took me then finally around about 5 years doing mathematics, because at that time, you know, now on our mobile, you see the sunrise and sunset. But I had to find programs. And then I was talking to guys to make it accurate. So I found out also that we have three different zero sea levels. Also, if you say you are living on a 0 meter sea level, there are three different existing in the world. So the Dutch using a different, and the height of the sea level is also important for the sunrise and sunset. You know? So I was completely confused, and it took me really a long time to figure out which mathematics are really good to calculate the times. So I managed all that, and then, you know, you see it, then we have different scales. That means if you deliver a watch to Hong Kong, we have a maximum of 45 minutes. Because they live so close to the equator. So this is more than the equation of time who influenced the sunrise.
I see what you mean.
And if you go to Oslo, then you have 7 hours on the scale. And I would make it, first of all, a little bit unusual, because I'm a little bit a fan of an asymmetry. So the crossed hands were unusual.
Yes. Yeah.
So if I have only a 7 hour scale and you go to Hong Kong throughout the year, you do not see the hands moving. So I found a way to measure really the cams. These are the two eyes you can see.
Yes. Huh? Yeah, yeah.
Who are responsible for the memory for the sunrise and sunset times. And then the different scales for all over the world. So at the end, we were really able, and I would say up to 9 hours, difference.
Wow.
I can't believe how fucking accurate it is, actually. Mm. I mean, really, really accurate.
Mm.
And, you know, Roman, you'll appreciate this. I've shared this with Martin, but you'll truly appreciate it. You know who loves this?
Mm, do they?
My rabbi.
Right. Okay. Wow. Well, look, it's a narrow market, but I guess if he tells his friends, that's fine. You know, that's
he's either paying us in cash or in diamonds. It's his choice, but he loves the watch.
It's really funny because at the beginning, a lot of people came to me and said, "Oh, Martin, this is perfect for hunters. Then they know when they can go right. out for hunting."
But sure.
Not one hunter bought an EOS. Yeah, then,
right.
Oh, it's very good for the Muslims. Then they know when they have to pray. Not one Muslim.
Right.
It's especially good during Ramadan. Is that what they're telling you?
Well, possibly. Let's solve this now. If there's any hunters listening, you know, the last watch, as far as I know, that was designed for hunters was the Gerald Genta Jafika, which was that bronze case, so you wouldn't get reflections off the case when you were checking your time. So the EOS watch is back in production. Yes. Now, I haven't checked this with these guys, but if you're a hunter who specifically wants one, you can talk to these guys about a bronze case. I'm sure that's doable now. Might cost a little bit extra, but, you know, if you want a hunter's EOS, so we can make it happen, right? I'm just signing you guys up for it now. I haven't checked.
Hunter's EOS.
Yeah, Hunter's EOS. Yeah, I'm sure actually what you could do is you could use like the name, because Martin used to name his models by the mythology things. I'm sure, who was the Huntress? Diana, I think, was the Huntress Diana. In the Greek mythology. Yeah. There you go. The EOS Diana, and we might have to find a male version of that. Apollo, I think, was the Hunter as well. So EOS
we
Apollo.
We make a PVD-coded case and a Panda Black dial.
See, that's the beauty of talking to an independent watchmaker. You can make things happen while thinking about it. So anyway, so if you're a hunter or if you have a specific need for a watch that tells you sunrise, sunset, you know, I'll put the names and links into the show notes. Get in touch. What I was going to say about the EOS, I remember as a newbie person getting into watches, getting interested in watchmaking, it blew my mind the way you approached watchmaking, you know, because at that time when you started, and I think EOS was launched in the year 2000, I think, or 2001 maybe.
2001.
2001, that's right, because 2003, I think, was Watch of the Year or something.
I introduced it in November 2000. We had the launch event in the Marriott Hotel in Frankfurt.
Yeah.
That was only prototypes.
That's right. So, and at that stage, nobody was doing what you were doing. Like there were no, you know, there was a few independent watchmakers, you know, Mr. Sven Anderson was around and Vincent Calabresi were around. George Daniels was around, of course. But we forget the early 2000, you know, like the Harry Winston Opus series was just starting. This sort of renaissance of independent watchmaking wasn't really on the horizon. And then you were a young guy, much younger than all the other independent watchmakers, doing something so creative and using astronomy as the base for your creativity and building this sort of series of watches from EOS to Boreas, adding complications. It was amazing to me. It was very inspiring, as I say, it's like to see this level of creativity and novelty. So it was really wonderful to see. And I think a lot of the independent makers who came after you kind of forget that whose shoulders they're standing on in kind of having a market or having collectors appreciating their work. So I just think it's really important that we revisit this time, early, late 90s, early 2000s, as really this blossoming of a new era. So well done you, sir.
Thank you.
I have a quick question for Martin, actually, on that remark. Because Martin, I mean, just because I know some things personally, you know, coming out of school, you were very, I don't know, what's the right word? The equation of time was a big fascination for you. So I wonder if all of the astronomical stuff that you think about is sort of based on your fascination of sidereal time or equation of time.
Yeah, everything, you know, everything is depending on each other. For instance, you cannot calculate the sunrise and sunset time without respecting the equation of time. You know, it's part of the formula to calculate that. So it was natural to bring that as a next step. And at the end, I really like it because the 90% of all the people do not know what is equation of time. What does it mean? Or what is the effect of our life? What is the effect in the nature? And to make something like that was always, I had only fun to do that. Simple. It's really pretty simple. It was not that I was keen to transform really this as a mathematic effect. It was to awake people's fantasy that they think what is really equation of time. Where does it come from? That was more my inspiration.
So in terms of the other complications sort of built upon equation of time, is the selene as well as the mechanism behind the accuracy of the moon phase also equation of time dependent in some way, or at least based on some of the wheel structure of equation of time?
Not really, no. That's not. The moon phase is a different mathematical formula. And you can make it more accurate, like the 128 years, but that makes no sense to make it more accurate. This is hard, 15 wheels more, and you have no advantage out of that. What drives me, what drove me to make this lean was I was really fed up with these two half circles and this smiley moon coming up. You know, that's
the Breguet style, the yeah. Abraham Louis Breguet style moon yeah, phase. Sure.
When I look out at the moon, I don't see this smiley moon.
You don't see a big wheel of cheese out there. You don't see a big smiley cheese.
Yeah. And then I said, okay, we have to find a different solution. And you see the moon all the time. If it's only a quarter, you can see the full moon. So, but not with these two half circles. So I said, okay, it was also a longer process, but it was clear that we have to make a glass, which is the moon, and we have a double side printing that you have a little bit of a 3D effect. And it stays steady, and then the shadow moves underneath. So it's exactly the opposite way. And that was a very, very clever construction at the end, because nobody copied the sunrise and sunset. But if you look now, there are a couple of other companies copying exactly my system. And 2 years later, Piaget, they held a press conference, and they said, oh, we developed a pretty new moon phase system, and the moon stands still and the shadow is moving. And the audience was clapping, but it was my invention.
Yes. Well see, that's the thing that used to, that actually still drives me crazy, is the often I see the independent watchmakers, boys and girls, men and women, who toil awake, have this great idea. And often, well, I mean, if they're lucky, they get to make a watch. Not all of them do to show that idea, or they make a prototype. And then a bigger brand will often, well, hopefully buy the idea, but more frequently steal the idea.
Yeah.
And never credit the original inventor and maker. Mm-hmm. And that drives me, used to drive me crazy then. I think nowadays we at least know about it a little bit more because of the internet, and the information's much more available. Whereas before, in early 2000s, when Piaget did that, who would have known that you had made the Selene that was your idea?
I'm gonna be a fangirl for a second my friend Marty Braun.
Happy to hand the mantle over to you.
Vacher and Constantine has ripped off our friend. Now, you can either say that's really awful, or you can say, well, it's Vacher and Constantine. Okay, now
that's a different, you know, that's a different story, because Vacherot had a couple of other complications, you know? But this is really insane, staying in front of hundreds of journalists and said, we made this moon phase happen. We is our invention. And that drove me crazy, much more than the Vosh one.
Sure. Yeah, I can sense the rage even now in your voice. So yeah, no, I completely understand.
No, I mean, if you're gonna do it like I say, Roman, I agree. I mean, even if you're one of the you know, holy trinities of watchmaking, but give credit where credit's due. I'm looking at a Vacheron Constantin watch, and it's got sunrise and sunset indicators on it, and a photorealistic moon phase. Come on now, give the man his due.
Yeah,
it's his due, not. Yeah. But at the same time, it is Vacheron Constantin, so maybe it's more of a compliment than anything. I don't know.
That's true. I saw that as a compliment.
Oh, well, that's good. See, you're a bigger man than I am. I would have seen it as an insult, but that's it.
It's less of an insult if they pay their annuity. That's where I think is the problem. They pay their annuity.
I fully agree. So I think that's where, you know, a lot of the big brands and even big names like, you know, let's say Jean-Claude Biver is on record saying, you know, the industry needs the independence of the spirit and the ideas generating thing. But not a lot of credit gets given to the people behind the scenes. It's getting a little bit better now, although not, I wouldn't say it's super transparent now. But back then it was certainly not happening in Jean-Claude Biver's own blancpain of the late 90s, early 2000s. But anyway, let's not go down that path. That's not productive. What I was going to say about Celine, though, is that photorealistic moon, we should explain to people what a photorealistic moon phase actually is. We'll put links in the show notes. But I think it was at that time, once again, I remember seeing the ad. I could never afford it at the time, but I remember seeing the ad, and there was actually a video ad that you could find on YouTube, I think. It's like quite a clever little video advertising. But when I saw that moon phase, which the moon that looks like the moon with the craters visible, it's brilliant. Even in the technology of that day, and printing it on must have been a real challenge, printing it on the thing. Maybe talk to us about that, Martin. How did you realize that concept in real life once you had the idea? How difficult was it to make?
You're right. Nowadays, you have lasers who can do it in a little bit a better way. But a friend of mine, he has a print shop, and we made hundreds of test printings. You know, this is because it has to be transparent. You know?
Yes.
And it's called... You know, it's a raster. I do not know. A grid, you know.
A grid, so, yes.
Yeah, yeah, we try to make the picture of a moon, or divided it in grids. You know?
Right.
We made it half, and so we printed half of the upper side and the other 50% from the downside. So we have a bit of a three-dimensional.
Oh, wow.
Smart.
It's so clever. Yeah, I'm looking at it now. And I'm like,
really
that's awesome. Yeah,
then,
I'm sure.
Material who does not reflect, you know, that when the light comes in, that they do have too many reflections. So to find the right material to print it on, and
Looking at the piece right now. Yeah, yeah, I'm looking at my piece now, and hearing the creators kind of talk about how they make things makes you appreciate these things so much more, you know, because you go, oh, yeah, of course. It's not as easy as I thought. I didn't think it was going to be easy, but... doing it on both sides to give it this sort of 3D effect, that's really something.
Yeah, it almost looks like it has relief, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it almost looks like you can see, like if you were to be able to run your finger across the top of it, you'd feel the craters and the mountains on. Yeah, it's really quite a nice job. You know, the only thing I would say is that, and like you and I have talked about, Roman, with the EOS, because I know your EOS has to go back to Germany. And unless you want it to stay on Colosseum time, I wouldn't want to deny you that. But, you know, if you need to know the time of the Vatican, that's good. You can stay with the way it is now. But
I said it it's like 6 months forward and actually works relatively well. I've moved it a few
perfect,
months. It actually works relatively well. We work around it.
He's down under, so he figured it out. You know, we were saying live in Alaska. What?
Utes, my friend Scotty is very picky sometimes, you know. If I were you and had this Roman watch, I would not care if it's really now accurate for Melbourne or not.
Correct. Exactly.
Me, I'm sending it back to Germany to get fine-tuned for sure.
Don't listen always to Scotty, you know. Sometimes it's very difficult.
No. For Melbourne, I will get one of the new editions, right? This is like, that's the game plan, right? Yeah. Sorry, Scott, I interrupted you. Yeah, sorry, you go.
But like with this watch, you know, this watch, and God bless my dear friend, this watch is set, the moon is set for Switzerland. So the moon doesn't ever look like this for me.
Yeah, no,
sideways.
Yeah, so I've learned to do it. So I had a chat with a previous guest of our show, the guy called My Horological Journey. It was a big collector of indie pieces. He taught me a trick where, because I'm in the southern hemisphere and the moon face is set for the north, he just said, you wear it upside down. You wear, instead of the moon face being a 12 o'clock, you wear it upside down with the crown to the left where I wear it, and it works really well. You know, so I just set the 12 o'clock or 6 o'clock. We make it work.
That works for you, but I can't wear the watch sideways.
That's true. Now you got to wear it in a pocket, like a pocket watch.
No, that's a good worker.
You know, our problem in reality was economical one, because the number of clients on the south side of
too small. Of course. Yeah, it is getting a little bit better now. I mean, I have to say there is a much greater appreciation of independent horology, certainly in Australia now. There is quite a dedicated group, but I understand, of course, it would not be just the population distribution. Yeah, of course, the Northern Hemisphere always takes precedent, which is why, you know, it's always exciting when we find a watch that has a moon face specifically designed for the Southern Hemisphere. Almost never happens, right? So we make it work. But no, but that's just, yeah, but it's, once again, like, just diving back through your memory banks and kind of going through the catalog of pieces, I'm really, like, it's just exciting to kind of hear the master talk about their creations. That's why I started this podcast in the first place, was kind of just people in the listeners, the horological enthusiasts need to kind of get a glimpse behind the scenes of kind of how these things get done and what the thinking behind it was. Mm-hmm. And another piece that I was going to ask you about is this model that I have recently, which is called the Notos, which has a earth declination indicator. So it's a complete calendar with a declination, maybe with an equation of time as well. We go back to the equation of time, the original kind of fascination. Maybe tell people what a declination of the earth is.
The declination is what the mankind sees every year. Winter is coming, summer is coming. And that's only the angle where the sun is actual this day is 90 degrees on the earth's surface.
Right.
It's pretty simple. You know? So it turns between the turning point of the Capricorn and the turning point of the Cancer.
Yes. I like when you just did like a little shrug, like I asked you what time of day it was. Like, you're like, yeah, in declination, obviously. What do you kids learn at school these days? Unbelievable. Honestly. Don't you get educated? But I mean, I think it's wonderful because, once again, I kind of obsess over astronomical complications, because to me there is nothing more poetic than a watch with an astronomical complication, because it really connects you to something bigger than our day-to-day, you know, rat race, you know.
I'm just glad
later on I made a construction with the world map.
Map,
and then you see a line with exactly the declination moving up and down. This is much more understandable for people.
Okay. Yeah. What? Where does one get one of those?
It's the declination of time. It indicates the declination of time. I would be frightened if it was able to indicate the declination of mankind, which we seem to be in the middle of anyway. So if Martin has a watch that can indicate the declination of mankind, this is it. This has a whole, this thing, this was on the back of a watch called the Astronomique, which was just phenomenal. I don't remember how many complications. I mean, Jesus Christ, it was the Breguet 160, for God's sake. And you would go on the back of it and you would literally tell this, like, you know, you've seen the map of the world. It's been pieced out into four sections.
Sure.
And you would line it up with where you were and the watch would do the rest, which is kind of complex.
That's so cool. That's craziness. That's insane. But it's just something so wonderful about, once again, having a wristwatch, which is mechanical wristwatch, we all agree is not necessary. But just having something on your wrist that kind of connects you to the bigger universe, there is just something so poetically beautiful.
Well, put your notos in the camera. Put your notos into, notos into the camera. Sorry, Martin, go ahead, because I want to talk about this.
All right.
See, look at what's going on here. What a man toy. What a beautiful man toy our friend designed here. And look at how beautiful it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's great that it tells you the time. That's fine. Nobody needs that. You got a phone. Sure. But look at that. That's fantastic.
Sure. Absolutely.
The dial is great. Absolutely. You know, the material of the dial is called coqolong. That's a mineral.
Yes.
It's not metal.
Yeah. And
but hold on, because this is something you don't know about Martin Braun.
Okay.
He is an expert in mineral collection.
Okay, right.
So that dial is inspired by any number of stuff that's compressed under incredible amounts of weight for thousands of years. These incredible crystals that he's found and pieces that he's found. It's amazing how that's crept into the watchmaking as well. So I just wanted to make that point. So
yeah, it makes it very special.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. So my Celine has a slice of meteorite on it. So it's a meteorite dial. Now I've got the Notos with.
Roman, can I show you?
Yeah, please. Yeah, please. Yeah, there
this
we go.
Was
perfect.
The back of the watch.
Yes.
The map.
Oh,
is declination.
Wow.
See, then the red line is moving up and down and show you the declination.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, we have to bring this back. At some point, we'll talk about EOS in a moment, the EOS relaunch, but we definitely need to talk about that.
Well, and you know, some of the stuff that Martin has done that's not necessarily astronomical, the Slow Runner.
Yeah, Runner's on my list as well.
He's you know, I don't want to be the fangirl, but it's a smart guy sitting between us here. So
absolutely.
Hold out some cool shit.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So let's just go back a little bit just so people understand kind of the chronology of what we're talking about. So Martin, you were educated. So you're born, we talked about that. So your dad was the specialist case maker, goldsmith, and you learned that. So you got educated at Pforzheim, isn't it? Pforzheim School of Watchmaking in Germany. What's the German education like for a young watchmaker? Is that the same as Swiss, kind of when you graduate? Is it just you can repair stuff? Can you actually make things when you graduate? What was the training like?
It's more or less it's the same. In Switzerland, they have two different kind of trainings. So one is only for the repairing stuff.
Sure.
And the other is a little bit more than like ours, so that people are learning how to make balance wheels and stems and so on.
Gotcha.
I would say the Swiss focus is more on wristwatches.
Uh-huh.
And we in Germany, we had more the full range, also clocks and the wristwatches. So at the end, I would say the Swiss training for wristwatches is better. The overall training for all watches is better in Germany.
Oh, interesting. So you get more rounded education in the German system, I understand. Yeah. Understand. Mm. Which I guess makes sense because later on we'll talk about you were involved in clocks for a long time. I think you're still involved in clocks now as well, looking at your website now. So it's a very rare talent. That's a very rare watchmaker. So it's a very rare horologist, shall we say, who can do watches, pocket watches like you and your dad did, and also clocks. That's a rare set of skills as well.
That's true. But, you know, to repair the clocks is not more or less like a hobby for me.
Sure.
As I know, we spend the winter in the south. And in the summer, you know, I'm a little bit too young to have 12 months of vacation. So little bit to do.
Well, those cold winters in Lucerne, that's right. That's why the clockmaking started, right? All the farmers went indoors, right?
Yeah. I'm not really keen to make wristwatches anymore. But the older you get, you know, I need already my reading classes and
also
if you're a little bit out of the wristwatch, you lose your skills.
Of course,
not damage and with clocks I can make it in God's sake until I'm 80. You know.
The tolerances are different, right? So in clocks, you work in millimeters. Yeah. And in wristwatches, you work in tenth of millimeters and hundredth of microns. Of course.
And on the other side, it's another reason is you know, all and that's good for me because all the watchmakers, they want to sit with their white coats, you know, and all the tools are well assorted.
Yeah, beautifully lined up. Yes, yes.
And in clocks, you know, you get oily fingers, you have grease everywhere, and I like that, you know. I can really do something with my hands.
Well, it's really interesting. So you're exactly right. So whenever I look at these, you know, the glossy brochures from all the big Swiss companies, it's always the same look. You know, whenever I have a picture, it's sort of this pristine bench with usually an older white man. You know, white coat, beautifully done, just with a loop, just hovering over a thing. But whenever I look at benches or photographs of like watchmakers I actually respect, particularly the independent watchmakers, it's always, you know, that's right. There's this sort of sleeves rolled up. There's crap all over the desk.
Yeah.
I don't know how they find anything. There's always like a broken wine. There's like a broken wine glass that's sort of turned over, covering a movement that's in progress. Yeah. You know, and you sort of go like that, and you can clearly see the joy of just creating where they're just, you know, they're just so full of ideas. They don't have time to put everything into its little holder. So I always trust I trust the dirty bench more than I trust this sort of beautifully disinfected, you know. Yeah. With watchmakers, I want a dirty bench. With somebody making a vaccine, I want a clean bench. You know, somebody's working in a microscope, give me a clean bench. But, you know, watchmaker, creator, show me some.
No, on my workbench, you cannot make wristwatches because if you do clocks, you have to substitute then the bushes and then you have these little flitterings and you have to polish something and there is greasy oil. It's almost impossible. Either you do the wristwatches or you have a separate room and then you make the clocks.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, there's really only one man who does both at the same time. That's David Walter, who is this brilliant clock and watchmaker. He's Australian-born, but currently now lives in California. And, you know, salute to David, who's is a previous guest and a friend. But he's really the only one, as far as I know, who does both, you know, he pursues both at the same time. But that you're right, that is super, super rare. So look, Martin. Let's talk a little bit about. So we've talked about the early part of Martin Braun, the brand. Martin Braun, sorry, the brand. Should we mention the difficult times? The Frank Mueller, who shall not be named. Maybe I don't know how you feel about things, but I think it would be good to just mention it so people know what happened in the first phase of the company and why the company hasn't sort of continued uninterrupted until now.
I mean, at the end, this is a very important part of the story. You know, then
I think so.
Because it's, you see, I was so quick, so successful.
But you went up.
Successful does not mean you have the money to be successful.
Sure. Sure.
And the watch industry, excuse me, but it's a kind of a bitch industry.
Sure.
So when I was then the first time in Basel, and I had the first Basel show, I think it was 2002. And, the people lined up outside,
right,
in my booth, and say, oh, I like your watch, I like your ears, and we do something. You cannot imagine. There are really people. They coming with such thick folders, full of pictures. You know, this is my store. I have this brand, and I will represent this and that. And and at the end, blah 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 blah.
Right, so right.
If you're young and you need the success, you run always a huge risk that you run in a trap. And so I did. I had one client, I do not name it, but from the first day we supplied him watches, he delivered to the gray market.
Right.
And he was acting like the wholesaler. So it was a disaster because they dumped the prices, and then you have a serious dealer like I had in the United States. And I said, Martin, what should I do? I cannot sell anymore.
I
have to leave. And instead of developing watches, you have to manage a lot of side economical problems.
Sure. So
the other thing is, if you're a young guy and you go to a big Swiss supplier and say, hey, can you make me these wheels? And I say, oh, no, forget it. We do not supply you. We work for Rolex, we work for Patek, but not for you. So, and with these two major problems, as it means production, plus the right dealers. Yeah, you stay in front of the Mount Everest. Such a huge amount of problems is there. And Frank Miller came to me and said, hey, Martin, we were looking and checking your product line. We find it pretty interesting. Wouldn't you come down to Geneva and introduce yourself? And I said, hey, wow, that's really amazing.
Of course.
So I went down and they promised for sure the heaven on earth, because they have a perfect distribution network worldwide, and they have, for all the parts we needed, they have facilities, productions, I said, hey, that's absolutely perfect for me. I knew that because of the reputation that I run a risk, here's the angel and here's the devil.
Always,
And so I said, hey, but this could be a one in a lifetime chance to do it. So I decided to do it. And honestly, the situation then was a pure disaster. We were collecting orders, but then in the first year, we had to take all the cases from the Frank Miller facilities. We didn't got one case. Not one. And Wartan told me, said, Martin, develop more, make more, enlarge your collection. And I did that.
Sure.
And so I spent a lot of money in new productions.
Sure.
A lot of back orders and couldn't deliver anything.
The
first year, they promised, now the situation become much better, blah, 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 blah. And I said, we used all our money. We are with a full order book. We are bankrupt. Then they took over the responsibility. That was then okay. And the next year, we had round about 5 million Swiss francs in back orders.
Wow.
We wrote on the WPHH. And then 2008... The world economic crisis started, and then Wartan became cold feet, and he dropped all the brands, including me. So I went bankrupt with more than 5 million in back orders.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
That was sad. you know.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
We never had a fight, you know. We never was arguing like Vartan and Frank Müller himself. So it was only, you know, same happened to Rodolphe. Rodolphe had a huge project with Ducati, huh? And Vartan said, "Well, no, we do not care," you know. And so he was thinking that if he is doing something, it automatically becomes a success, like he has the success with Frank Müller. But with all the other brands, that was not happen. With the smaller brands, it was work, you know. It's work to develop it. It's a lot of work to convince the customers. And then with the distribution, you know, they took the people in the main, do you know Watchland? Have you been there?
Yes, Martin, the Frank Mueller's, the factory sort of thing. So
they took their clients in the castle and we were in the tent beside.
And
they never said, "Hey, go to our other brands."
They try to get customers for their own brand. Right.
And so I was talking to Vartan and said, "Hey, Vartan, we are staying in the desert there. You know, what should we do? You know, I cannot go and take your clients by the hand and bring them to the tent. It's yours. You have so many wonderful, pretty girls running around. They have to take their clients and show them around."
Sure.
And then she said, "Martin, that's your problem."
I said, "Yeah, it's." I mean, I remember reading I remember the news because I think you left that. You left your own brand. You left your name behind. You know, I think it was 2009. I think you left Frank Müller. And I remember at that stage, you know, I was interested in independent watches. I was reading the news a lot. And I remember when that news broke that the partnership between Martin Brown and Frank Müller didn't work out and Martin Brown was leaving. And I remember just kind of mentally adding your name to the list of these amazing independent watchmakers who were chewed up by the industry and then sort of spat out, you know, anyone from Gerald Genta to Daniel Roth to Roger Dubuis. And I just remember feeling Peter Speak, Mariner, that size of Peter Speak. It seems to be this ongoing thing. What would be your advice? I mean, I don't know if the industry has changed better now. I'm not convinced it has. If you had any advice to somebody, a younger Martin or a new brand, a new watchmaker listening to this right now, what would be your advice? What words of wisdom would you say? And feel free to use any language you like. But genuinely, it's a genuine question. I think it's an important issue that not enough people talk about. I think that.
You know, for me, it was 2 years of being tortured, you know, not delivering cases and then with a full order book. And then it was a logical consequence for me to go out because I was already felt that my health is not that good anymore. You know, I was
stressed. That bad. That's awful.
I was on the edge, you know.
And you were a young man at that time as well. Like, you know, you were just starting your career, not heading towards the end of your career.
Right. And then, look now on Peter Speak Marin, my friend Peter, how long he was spanked from his investor.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He was also said, "I cannot anymore, you know. I'm done. I'm through. I'm cooked."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then you have to go out. So looking back, I would say, I do not know if it would work better, but I would prefer to stay smaller instead of trying to become that big.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So for an innovator, so stay small. So be careful of investors or just don't engage with investors at all.
Investors are the worst.
Right.
So you know probably my friend Rainer Brandt.
Yes, of course. Another.
He is small, but he is since 25 years on the market. He's doing his business. He has no investor. He survived.
Yeah.
So that would be my Curry is a different story, Scott. It's a little bit a different story.
Right.
Yeah. You never know. You never, Scott, you never know. You know, that's true.
Look, I mean, thank you for sharing the story and being really open about it. I think it's important to share these sort of stories, particularly from, you know, I won't say industry veterans, but people who've worked in the industry, who've done production, who've done design, who've done the full cycle of making watches and trying to sell watches and kind of giving advice to younger, to the next generation coming through. I think it's really important. Because I sort of agree with you to a sense of making the watches the easy part. I mean, obviously, it's very hard. It's way beyond what I can do. But, you know, there are many talented watchmakers who come out. They have an idea. And now making it would be easier. You know, there's 3D printing. There's prototyping. Technology has moved on, you know. So making the thing and realizing your idea is, you're right, easy. But then the harder part is the business side of things, and particularly if the industry is not really set up to nurture talent, but more to use talent and then spit it out purely as a means of investment. Mm. I think it's really important to let those talented people know what to watch out for, because we don't want to lose talent.
When you are, if you go to a jeweler store, you know, and said, "Hey, I'm Martin Brown," and the jeweler says, "Oh, I heard about you. I like it. I will take it," you know, and they put it in the window, in the front window, and then the Omega sales guy is coming and said, "Oh, no, we don't want that." The Washer guy is coming and said, "Oh, no, you know, and then, hey, if we have the watches the next time in the window, we don't give you the novelties, you know, and if you make 80% of your turnover with Omega or whatever, then you think twice about to keep the Martin Brown watch in the showcase. So they give us really a very, very hard time.
Yeah,
they
yeah,
have
yeah.
Done the jewelers by the balls and they use the market for us.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we should say there are some good independent dealers now, and there's a few that, you know, we need to kind of acknowledge, and there are some good eggs in there for sure. Scott's waving his hand, and absolutely. You know, in the US, in Australia, there's usually one or two in each country. And if you find those have to be treasured, because they do a great job about educating their consumers about the talent that's coming up.
And that brings me to my point before. Stay smaller, keep your production smaller, you know. And then you can have a perfect work with these independent dealers. But at the end, I sold 4,000 Dios. You know, we had almost a running in this industrial production. So it was not enough with the independent dealers. So we needed surely the professional dealers. And that was my mistake, you know, because, we have a successful product, you know, and we become a well-known brand. That is much more difficult than I expected in the beginning.
Sure. So do you think you would have been, in retrospect, thinking back on it now, would you have been happier selling 400 EOS through a smaller network of dealers than 4,000, but having to move a lot of units?
Right. You know, at the top, I had 17 employees.
Wow. Yeah. You know? Wow.
Yeah. And you have to feed 17 employees.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I always think of that, you know, whenever I talk to, because often I would get, you know, independent watchmakers kind of sometimes we either chat with them or they sort of contact me for advice. Not that I can give out advice, but we sort of talk about this. And I usually say, you know, if it's just you touch every watch that goes out of your workshop, you're really connected to things. As soon as you start having 2, 3, 5, 7 other watchmakers, even though your name is on the dial, your hands are not in every watch. And then you become a people manager, not a watchmaker, right?
That's right.
So then and that people are much harder to manage than bits of metal. So people are always will take up a lot more of your time dealing with HR issues, and these two people aren't getting along, and you know this one's on leave, and they all want to be not work on school holidays or whatever.
Yeah.
So that takes up most of your time, not the watchmaking.
You know, at the end, you know, it's I assembled my last year's. I think 2002, 2003. And the rest of my career, I was only running around the world, you know, flying from one country to the others, fulfilling investor requirements, needs.
Sure. Huh?
So the only thing I did is to give my ideas to my engineer. My designers. We exchange then the ideas and constructions, but the rest.
You don't have time to create. That's the thing. You don't have time to create because you're always hustling that. So hopefully this is useful. We don't mean to bring the people listening to this down, but I think it's really important to hear, to share these stories. I really do. So thank you. So I always think of this thing as the watch production grows and the man or woman whose name is on the dial no longer has their hands in the watches, they're still ultimately responsible. And if quality goes down or their reputation changes, it's not the person at the bench that's going to wear the brunt of that. It's going to be the guy or girl whose name is on the dial, who might not have had anything to do with the watch. And I think that's the danger of growing too big, is that you lose touch with the production, but you are still ultimately responsible for the thing. And Martin, tell me if I'm wrong. Tell me if I'm reading
I agree. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's an unwinnable thing, I think, becomes when you get too big, it's unwinnable because you're managing people and then you're always worried that the people you are entrusting your name to don't have the same connection because that's not their creation. They're trying to do what you told them to do. They don't necessarily love it or want to do it to the same degree that you would, so because it's not their name on the thing.
Yeah. You know,
Well,
also, you know, the marketing costs are tremendous. You spend more money for marketing than for the development.
And I think so on this podcast, we've talked a lot about, because I have a very soft spot for the generation of watchmakers, independent watchmakers who came before the Instagram years, right? Because I think you guys and girls paved the way for the current wave of indie watchmakers, whether it's Simon Brett or Lacombe, whoever, there's a whole ton of them. But there was this generation of the AHCI members and indie watchmakers who toiled, shall we say, in obscurity, in relative obscurity, because the internet wasn't set up then. You know, there were forums, but the forums weren't, the picture sharing wasn't as good, the social media wasn't available. So you were unlucky in your timing. I suspect we're in now, I think it'll be hopefully much, much easier to build your following now and get the new generation EOS out there into the world, because people can share the watches they make. The excitement can build much more organically.
That's right.
So I think you're just unlucky. Yeah. So we talked a lot about the history. So I know after you left the Frank Mueller thing, you started another creation. It was Antoine Martin brand, and you had some really, once again, really interesting, really clever things like the Slow Runner with this large balance wheel. Once again, so your creativity kept growing. I want to make sure we spend time talking about what you're working on now, which is getting the EOS, the original Sunrise Sunset watch, back. I'm very, very excited about this because I think in many ways this will be the creation that propelled you up, and I'm so excited that the new generation of watch collectors can now enjoy it. So maybe let's talk about that now. Okay. What made you come out of the woodwork and relaunch the EOS? And let's talk about that now.
The story is Frank Mueller gave up the name registration. So we found it out. So then we took the name back.
Yeah. Excellent.
And that's cool. And at the end, I was not really willing to do something on my own. You know, I wouldn't start again. You know, I have now. I made my business. You know. I'm very calm, I'm quiet, and I'm in good condition, and I don't want to start that again. So I was talking then to my friend Frank and said, hey, well, Frank, you know, we can start with the EOS, but I am only your personal advisor. You know, I support you right. with this interview. If we have to go to a show, we can do that, but not more. You know, no production, sure. nothing. So, and that's the whole story in 1 minute.
Yeah, no, that's good. So, and once again, knowing your experience with the watch industry, I can understand what you're reluctant to jump with both feet back. I totally, yeah. totally get that. From a purely collecting horological point of view, I think it's amazing that the EOS is back. Like, absolutely. I think it is awesome. Like, it, yeah. so let's talk about. So, Scott. Maybe let me throw to you, because I know you've been involved a bit more on the getting the brand relaunched. Do you want to talk about the process and kind of how people should get in touch? What's the process for getting one ordered? How to get it customized for your location?
So here in the States, or especially here on the West Coast, you can feel free to give out my contact information. Typically what we do is... I place an order. I let the people over there in Germany know what the end customer wants, where they are, what their city is, so that the cams on the watch can be properly configured. There are a number of customizations that they will do at the manufacturer. For instance, cam color, hand color, date color. It's really kind of cool. I've got some examples that I can show if necessary. The blue cams are very popular. Yeah.
Sure, I bet.
As far as metals go, right now the watch is available in stainless steel only. So there's no noble metals. So and anybody who has an existing EOS, they've already agreed that they'd be willing to service them and take care excellent. Of it that way. So that's why I say not that you should change yours from the Spanish Steps time zone or whatever, or the Trevi Fountain. You need to know the time there. But, you know, somebody may have an EOS and they've moved from, say, New York to Los Angeles or vice versa. There was a conversation we had with somebody the other day. If they lived in Alaska, I think that sunrise hand is always up. Or it's always down. I can't remember which. So... Yeah. So any of that stuff, yeah, I'm taking care, I'm representing sales here. And if people are local and want to actually, you know, feel the watch and the metal, I actually have a couple of examples brand new in the boxes.
Fantastic. So who is making the watches then? Are you able to reveal? Like, ahead, where are Mark. They being made?
In Germany.
Right. Is there a company that's doing it? Yeah. Do they do other watches as well?
Yeah, they do the moon face.
They do the Celine.
Yeah.
Is correct. That Schaumburg? Is that the company?
Exactly.
Schaumburg. Oh, of course. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Beautiful. So they're already making the Celine, which would show, and they've been doing that for a number of years now, I believe.
Right.
And this one is actually super cool. It's a green meteorite dial. So, I mean, they do some really nice stuff. Now, just so you know, just to be really specific, they've held true to Martin's DNA. That's what I want to make sure. So even though they're manufacturing their own watches, the EOS has, you know, it has the original crown. Yeah. It has the original coin edge casing. It has the original German lugs. So all of the DNA on the Martin Braun branded watches are holding true to the Martin Braun DNA.
Oh, that's really good to know. So, Martin, are the dimensions of the new EOS, exactly the same as the old one?
Exactly.
So it's one-to-one?
One-to-one.
Right. Oh, fantastic.
And also the technique inside is exactly the same, so that makes the servicing possible. Uh-huh. And in the next year, we come with more stuff, so step by step we will grow. Uh-huh. And Frank is doing
great.
Exactly in this way. He makes not the big quantities. Right. He's a small company. He has a couple of very well selected dealers. And so we can do exactly what I said before. Stay smaller, but constant.
And to that point, if there are people interested in the Schaumburg version of the Celine, I also represent that here as well.
Very cool. I have to say, before I managed to lay my hands on the original Celine, I was circling around the Schomburg Celine. It was very close.
It's nice that you have this, like you were saying, you know, horizontal collection of Martin Braun. It's really nice because you can see clearly if you lay all three watches out together, they're all members of clearly of the same.
Absolutely. So knowing that Schomburg can now service the watches, I think gives even more security, peace of mind.
Right.
A, to the original collectors, will also help to stabilize the secondary market for the vintage pieces and give security to the people buying the new watches that, you know, yes, there's servicing available. You know, all of these things help support the relaunch in a really nice way. So well done to you, gentlemen, for
you cannot imagine how frustrating it was for me, not that I was not able to help my clients because Frank Miller didn't give me one piece, nothing, you know. And that is awful. But now the problem is almost solved, and that makes me happy.
Yeah, it's great. Absolutely. So the little anecdote here. So I'm in Melbourne and there is a Frank Mueller store for some reason. I've never seen any customers go into it, but there is a store on Collins Street, if any of our Australian listeners are here. I went in once with my EOS just to check if they could do just general servicing, you know, because it's an ETA-based movement, isn't it? There's just a module on top, but it should be relatively easy to service. They had not even heard of this was a number of years ago. They didn't even know that was a relationship between your brand and their brand. I'm sorry to say. They sort of looked at me like, we've never seen this. Who, what, huh?
Confirmed exactly what I said before. Frank Müller didn't introduce us with their clients.
Yeah. So we wish that brand, well, I won't say all the success, but we wish that brand exactly the level of success they currently have. I think that's exactly the level of success they deserve. But I'm from a purely fangirl level. Oh. I think it's wonderful. So it's wonderful when people start to get the recognition they deserve, I think. And, you know, we talked about, you know, somebody like Sven Anderson, for example. Similar, I think, situation, you know, wasn't recognized for the genius that he was for a long time. And I think the appreciation is starting to grow now. You know, unfortunately, Mr. Anderson himself is getting older, but at least there is more interest and more scholarship in his watches. There are similar things with Mr. Vincent Calabresi. Again, another, you know, sort of early independent maker, once again, struggled for the longest time, genius unrecognized, amazing watches that are slowly starting to get their due. And it all comes down to, I think, scholarship. The more people know, they learn about these things, particularly for these pre-Instagram, pre-internet kind of pre-Hodinkee, shall we say, for the young, really younger new people into the hobby. You know, there's a whole kind of this swath of information to learn. So I'm really glad that you guys are back. The EOS is back. Hopefully that's a perfect way to get appreciation for Martin's work again. So I salute you guys for doing the hard thing as getting that show back on the road. So I admire the bravery
I'm not going to rest until I get a Martin Braun EOS on Taylor Swift's wrist. So that's what we're working
on. Oh, there you go, Scott. You and Martin are always after the young
Braun
people,
EOS
Martin.
On Taylor Swift's wrist, and then we can't make enough of them. I promise you that.
No, you know, you don't want that. We've had that situation before.
We'll go ahead and welcome that situation now. We'll be okay with it now.
Right. So, Taylor, if you're listening, and we know you do, please get in touch. I'll put all the links and I'll put contact details for you guys. And Taylor.
Taylor, I got number 13 for you, and I got number 14 for that guy from the Chiefs, whatever his name is.
I was going to say, that's exactly what I was going to say. She's got this new boyfriend who plays football. He needs a watch. So whatever his name is, it's not a sport we follow in Australia, so I don't know. So I couldn't tell you what he does in the team or what. Anyway, let's not get distracted here. But look, gents, Martin, it's been amazing to get to talk to you, to hear the passion that is still burning in your voice and the wisdom. So thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for sharing the knowledge and experience and being open about your experience. So I really want to acknowledge and appreciate that. So it's been lovely to talk about it. Scott, you tell us what's the best way, or Martin, you tell us, is there a website or an Instagram thing? How do people get in touch? What's the best way for them to get in touch with you guys?
You want to go first?
EOS.
Yeah, you don't really contact Martin. He doesn't want any, he doesn't want to be bugged when he's in Spain. He doesn't want to be bugged when he's back in
too many fanboys and fangirls. So I've already done this bit.
On, but then you can put my contact in the notes.
Well done.
It's scott@scottgoldman.net. So scott@scottgoldman.net. Phone number +1 310-963-7867. I've got 3 brand new watches in stock ready to go, but that's easy to get things from wherever you are to wherever they need to be. That's easy too. Especially if you're, like we said earlier, if you're moving from one zone to another, we can get the watches reconfigured as well. So, and like that.
Awesome. Brilliant. Well, guys, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough. It's been an absolute joy and a pleasure. Hopefully it wasn't too painful for you.
No, thank
either.
You, Roman.
I enjoyed it.
We pretty much talked to you all day.
Well, thank you so much, Martin. It's been a privilege, an honor, and a pleasure. Scott.
Thank you, likewise. Roman.
Thank you, buddy.
And you, buddy.
Thank you all so much, guys. Right. Stay on time.